to reconfigure the map of the world in the Catholic imagination. To the Canberra Catholic, consequently, Rome, Venice, Lisbon and Paris may have seemed just as close to South Canberra as Delhi, Calcutta, even Madras. The presence of European clergy and missionaries, with whom the Catholic may have had more regular contact, may only have served to corroborate that perception. This phenomenon was to some extent reflected in the fact that Catholic inhabited a world that was at once cut across by civil and ecclesiastical boundaries, that marked civil and ecclesiastical jurisdictions that were not necessarily coterminous. Bearing only civil jurisdictions in mind, South Canberra was part of the Madras Presidency, which was in turn part of the British or British India, which in turn was part of the British Empire, the respective capitals of which could said to be Mangalore, Madras, Calcutta, London. But bearing ecclesiastical jurisdictions in mind, Catholic South Canberra was split between the Archdiocese of Goa and the Vicariate of Irrapally, Malabar. Further, as the government of a mission would have been entrusted to a province of a religious order, and South Canberra was a mission, the jurisdiction of South Canberra, through much of its history, would have been under the government of various Portuguese orders, or the Italian province of the Carmelites, then the French province of the Carmelites, and then the Venetian province of the Society of Jesus. Consequently, making their respective centres, Lisbon, Rome, Paris and Venice, equally relevant. Thus the Catholic might have seen himself as existing at once on at least two, but possibly many more, distinct but often overlapping worlds, with multiple centres that, very broadly speaking, marked out two planes of existence, two transnational social fields, a complex British imperial social field and a much more complicated Catholic ecclesiastical social field. What I wish to then argue is that, owing to colonial nationalist interpretations, the hybrid Catholic, even through the post-colonial lens, is still seen as occupying the liminal space between Britain and India, or Portugal and India, or Europeans and Indians, or Christians and Hindus. Topics popular in the history of South Asian Christians thus include enculturation of Christian practice, a role of Christians in the nationalist movement. Now, while I do not deny that Catholics did occupy a liminal space, the liminal space was not between Britain and India, but between the two distinct, though often overlapping planes of their existence, in which they simultaneously operated, and which they constantly sought to unify on a single plane. Now, from this perspective, you have Britain and India, both on one hand, Britain and emerging India, on the one hand, the imperial plane, and then you have Catholic Europe and Catholic India, on the other hand, the ecclesiastical plane. Identities were being forged in the dialectical processes emerging out of changes in both planes. The liminal space the Canberra Catholic occupies is thus not between Europe and India, but between an imperial and a Catholic world, both of which are changing, both of which are reflecting him, and where lessons he's learning from one, he's often transplanting into the other. Now, while the changes in the imperial plane have already been discussed, I will focus now on the ecclesiastical plane. The pressure imposed by the perceived incorporation of local caste and outcast groups to religious majority being formed, consolidated, and even politicised at the national level, reveal the cracks in the foundation of the Catholic Church in South Canberra and the subcontinent as a whole. A single national Catholic community did not exist, and the Catholic population was divided along lines of region, caste, class, race, and language. These diverse Catholics were held together as Catholic primarily because of membership in a local parish church and the place of that parish within this hierarchical, worldwide structuring of the global Catholic Church. But the structuring itself would emerge very much as a cause of dispute. As a result of the papal bulls, this is just a bit of a background, as a result of the papal bulls in the 15th century that granted the West and the East drawn along an imaginary meridian to Spain and Portugal, it also placed under the royal patronage of their respective crowns a system called patriado, the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of the churches therein. In the Indian subcontinent, the bishoprics of Goa, Cochin, Cranconoe, and San Tome Mylapore came under the Portuguese patriado. But following the decline of Portuguese power in the 17th century, all with the exception of Goa fell into neglect. This prompted the Holy See to intervene by carving out vicariates, and then entrusted to the newly founded Sacred Congregation of Propaganda Fide,
founded in 1622, which administered them particularly through Trubicus Apostolic. The relationship between the churches under Pateroddo and Propaganda was tense, particularly in the 19th century, after formerly Portuguese territories such as Canara came under Britain, and several new vicariates were established. In 1670, Canara, which had been part of the Archbishopric of Goa, was placed under the vicariate of Malabar, later Verapolis. But as Portugal refused to recognise the appointment of a vicar apostolic that did not receive the consent of the Portuguese crown, there were rival claimants to Canara, and the parishes were themselves split in allegiance between Goa and Malabar. Largely, due to the initiatives of the Catholics themselves, the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of Canara was formally transferred to the vicariate of Verapolis by the Holy See in 1838. It was then declared a pro-vicariate in 1845, a vicariate in 1853. In 1886, Pope Leo XIII introduced the Catholic Hierarchy of India, which brought together two ecclesiastical units under Pateroddo and 17 under Propaganda in a single national hierarchy. Now, coming back to space, the hierarchy was significant because it provided a structural framework on the ecclesiastical plane that was roughly coterminous with the subcontinent on the civil plane. Also, because like civil vicariates, Mangalore was elevated to the status of diocese. Hence, it is very relevant. And apart from the ever-changing structural organisation, a great disunity prevailed within churches at the local level, owing to an acute shortage of priests until the 1830s. The absence of any local institution binding these institutions together in South Canara and the shortage of priests resulted in the unity between the parishes in South Canara being only notional. How then, one might ask, did the church in South Canara survive and survive and flourish, in fact? The response lies in the system of indigenous lay Catholic social organisation, practiced in conjunction with the system of ecclesiastical organisation introduced by the church from the outside. Within the Gurkhara system, as it was called, a parish was divided into many wards, or vados. Within each vado, often more than one landed Catholic family lived. From the leading landowning Catholic family, the head would be appointed as a Gurkhara or chief. The Gurkhas and the various villages of the parish would in turn form a managing committee called the Junta. In the absence of priests, the Gurkhas would serve. There were two priests serving the entire district of South Canara. So the absolute acute shortage of priests, the Gurkhas would serve as both religious and civil leaders of the Catholics. Managing, the Gurkhas are lay Catholic leaders, managing on behalf of the Catholic priests not only temporal responsibilities such as dispute resolution, church financing, and general management, but also spiritual responsibilities, such as the administration of sacraments, officiation of baptisms, marriages and funerals, and regular supervision of the parish households. All this from 1838, once South Canara was handed over to the Italian Carmelites at the Vicariate of Verapolis, there would be no shortage of priests. The Gurkha system remained in practice through the period of study well past 1950. Apart from the local rootedness of the parishes, the hybrid system facilitated, it also resulted in the development of popular devotion among the lay Catholics, and, more importantly, an empowerment of the Catholic laity to levels almost unknown of in Catholic Europe in the day. While the Carmelites, being a contemplative order, could effectively harness the popular devotion as evident in the success of their contemplative monasteries, well, the introduction of the Carmelites marked a new phase of tensions between clergy and laity. For the French Carmelites, fresh from Europe, where, you know, they've been exposed to the changing relations between church and state following the French Revolution, that the laity in South Canara should consider themselves kings of the church was preposterous. Not only were the religious responsibilities taken away from the Gurkhar by the clergy at once, but the clergy also sought to regulate the intervention of the Gurkhas in temporal affairs by requiring that the parish priest be present at every Junta meeting. Even the status of the Junta as a legitimate controlling body was being questioned by the Carmelites. For the Gurkhas, the Carmelites had gone a step too far. One method through which the parish church exercised control in the parish was through the control of parish schools. From the 1840s, due to the demands of Canon Catholics themselves, several schools were founded among the Carmelites. Though done so with clerical consent, the schools were mostly initiated and financed by the Catholics themselves. One Carmelite vicar apostolic, Michael Antony, set up a school committee, a French Carmelite, set up a school committee of influential lay members to found schools. But when two lay members from this committee formed a school without seeking his consent, the bishop issued an order that if the school were not to be shut down at once, both founders would be excommunicated. Greatly discontent with what they perceived to be the Carmelites' love for excessive control over the laity, the Catholics repeatedly petitioned the Pope between 1858 and 1878 for the replacement of the Carmelites with the Jesuits. The Carmelite attitude of prayer, supplication and contemplation, they complained, was not sufficient for Catholics living in a competitive, changing world. They needed schools, not monasteries. They needed to be taught, the laity needed to be taught, to fight battles, not to surrender to the priests in quiet contemplative meditation. They complained not only of Carmelite clergy seeking to exercise excessive clerical control, but also the fact that they did not speak English, they were French. And we are British loyalists in the British Empire. What are the French Catholics doing here? And the French Carmelite missionaries were already under the radar of suspicion of the British authorities. That is affecting the status of these Catholics who are positioning themselves in the period as loyalists, Catholic loyalists in the British Empire. And the discourse is entirely filled with why we are not like the Irish. The Irish are stupid. The Irish don't recognise the greatness of Britain. We are the Catholic loyalists of the British Empire. And we don't want the French. Now, due to the Canon Catholic petitions to Rome, the Holy See entrusted the Mangla mission to the Venetian province of the Society of Jesus. As an act of order, in contrast to the contemplative Carmelites, the Jesuits would be largely successful among the very ambitious Canon Catholics. The primary reason the Canon Catholics sought the Jesuits was because they sought an order that could build them schools that taught them English, and more importantly, provide them with a centre of higher learning, like St. Xavier's College in Bombay, which they knew existed through the German Jesuits. Now, the moment the first batch of Jesuits got down from Italy after the long journey to Bombay, four Canon Catholics went up to Bombay to meet them and said, you do realise, this is what they said, you do realise the reason we've invited you is because we want a college. Go to St. Xavier's, have a look at what it is, and we want the same in our district. Now, this is not, of course, in Catholic records. This is in the Vatican records where these discourses are found today. Now, in fact, the successful establishment of St. Aloysius College, less than 4 years after the Jesuits arrived, revealed the particular strength the Jesuits had where education was concerned. But their private correspondence in Rome and Venice, revealed in the archives there, reveals a shockingly different picture of Jesuit frailty, fatigue and frustration. The Jesuits, after all, were not English but Italian, and few, if any, could speak English, to the satisfaction of the Catholics of Mangalore. For that purpose, the Jesuits had to request the Jesuit mission in Bombay to release three English priests for a few years. But once this priest left in the mid-1890s, the Venetian Jesuits were left in a dire strait. The only Anglophone Catholics of the district were indigenous scholastics, but they had not completed their education. Now, the records of the Jesuit archives reveals letters constantly written, secret, confidential letters, constantly written by the Jesuit Bishop Pagani to the provincial general in Venice, explaining the difficulties they faced in the mission due to the lack of English. But not receiving much sympathy from Venice, where the provincial general said, if you can build a school like St. Aloysius in the same using the same architecture as a grand Roman classical building, why can't you people learn English? I'm not going to employ any more English people here. It's embarrassing for me as provincial general. So the Jesuits, poor Bishop Pagani, had to go to the superior general in Rome. Well, this is very rare. He contacted the superior general who supervised all the missions of the Jesuits. He contacted him directly and said, he raised the matter with him. Now, while Pagani passed away the next year, his successor, Bishop Cavardini, Venetian Jesuit, reported in a private letter to the superior general how before he died, Pagani went even to the Pope and the Holy See, pleading with them for the grant of an English bishop, because the Catholics in Anglo would have nothing else. Cavardini sympathetically acknowledged that the Jesuits had underestimated the Catholics of South Canara and thought their reasonable English education would be enough, but he quipped with frustration, "No matter how excellent a knowledge of English a bishop might command," I'm quoting him, "the Catholics in Manglo will never be satisfied. No bishop will ever be respected in Manglo unless he knew English perfectly well." The Venetian Jesuits are compelled to send a batch of Jesuits to the Jesuit seminary in Roehampton, England, at their own expense, to acquire language skills needed for this very demanding mission. It is interesting, thus, how while the lay Catholics seek the Jesuits to provide them schools that will provide them English education so they can culturally anglicise, the lay Catholics compel the Italian Jesuit clerics to themselves undergo cultural anglicisation first. Now, the second arrow in the Jesuit missionary quiver were Catholic associations, such as confraternal associations. Now, it gets even more interesting. Confraternal associations, such as congregations, I love studying Rome. Confraternal associations, such as congregations and sodalities, characterised the Italian social landscape and were particularly associated with the Jesuits since the Counter-Reformation. Confraternal associations are voluntary associations that aim to foster devotion among its members. Aimed, however, in the Jesuit case, it's always special, to bring into closer and regular contact with the Jesuit a number of lay Catholics which would make their spiritual direction easier. Thus, while confraternal associations in a sense appeared like the empowerment of laity, it was actually a Jesuit strategy to fan popular devotion without undermining clerical authority. No sooner, as had happened in the Carmelite period, now no sooner had the Jesuits arrived in South Canara, they founded an array of confraternal associations like they were in Venice. 1879, the first vicar of the cathedral introduced a sodality of the Immaculate Conception for the Blessed Virgin Mary for Catholic men. Then you had the presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary and the Assumption for junior and senior students of the college. Then, of course, now the Catholic Church has been regulated, the Catholic space has been regulated, now we need the Catholic home. They founded the Catholic Mother's Sodality. Between 1880 and 1930, a number of other sodalities sprung up. Sodality of Children of Mary for girls, altar service sodality of St. John Birchman's for boys, the sodality for ladies, the sodality of St. Joseph for tailors, the Congregation of Sacred Heart and Legion of Mary for merriness. In addition, the Jesuits encouraged the foundation of numerous Catholic social, religious and political associations that were largely founded and managed by the lay Catholics, but spiritually directed by the Jesuits. The purpose of these institutions was not only to strengthen the bonds between Catholics, but to create a perception of strength that the Jesuits felt was essential for minority in a changing subcontinent. Most importantly, through these associations, it was hoped that to present lay Catholics a Catholic alternative to non-Catholic associations the Jesuits feared the Catholics might otherwise join. The Church openly condemned the rising threat of socialism, liberalism, modernism and nationalism in the Catholic press in Manglo, even though these issues had not even risen in South Canara. By presenting a Catholic alternative each, backed by strong Catholic associations. Basically, the social landscape in South Canara thus became, under the Venetian Jesuits, almost an extension of the social landscape the Venetian Jesuits had left behind in Venice. Now, the Risorgimento, or the political and social movement that saw the unification of Italy following the Congress of Vienna in 1815, right until 1871, had not only exacerbated the Catholic Church's apprehension about liberal nationalism and modernism, it also dissolved the Papal States, effectively limiting the Pope's territory to the Vatican. The developments had raised opposition all across the Catholic world, and the pages of Catholic Manglo press were replete with reports and opinion pieces on the Roman question. Furthermore, following the European revolutions of 1848 and rapid industrialization in Europe, there would also emerge a growing consciousness in Europe of the divide between the working class and the business class. Pope Leo XIII sought to address this divide through his encyclical Rerum Novarum in 1891. Pope Pius would do the similar through Quadragesimo Anno in 1931. While the Church was resolutely against communism and also critical of socialism and liberal capitalism, it recognised that it was in its interests for Catholics